Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you do without your favorite fruit? In this country, bananas are that favorite by far. On average, each of us eats close to 30 pounds of them a year. They're sweet, creamy, and remarkably consistent. While one apple, peach, or berry might be more tart or sweet or tender than the next, a banana's only variable seems to be the stage of ripeness at which you eat it. But therein lies a serious problem. Because they are all genetically identical to one another, the bananas we know and love are endangered, susceptible to a virus that some experts predict could wipe them off the planet within a decade. So what's being done to save the fruit? And how did bananas go from a tropical mainstay to a worldwide sensation in just a few decades' time? Dan Coppell is a science and nature writer. His book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, is out now in paperback. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So the world eats 100 billion bananas a year, and they are all essentially clones of one another.
That's basically true. We're actually talking about the Cavendish breed of banana, which is the commercial banana that we eat. That's about 50% of the world's bananas. But the rest of those bananas are very close to each other and the Cavendish, and they are also susceptible to this disease and several other diseases which are devastating the world banana crop. So the entire world banana crop is in grave danger. Our Cavendish banana is the most endangered banana, though.
How did this happen that they became so much like one another?
Well, the reason is that it's the reason for the banana's popularity is that they're so much like each other. Because bananas are clones, they're incredibly easy to grow. They're consistent. You plant a banana and you're guaranteed another banana. They're seedless and they taste all the same. So when you take a banana, you just pull basically a piece of a banana out of the ground and you stick it in the ground and another banana tree grows. And people have been doing this for 7,000 years, which is why it's not only one of the most popular fruits, but it was the very first cultivated fruit crop. So over the years, bananas have been this consistent crop that people have relied on for nutrition. And so it's the banana's popularity, which has accelerated during the industrial era, that makes it so endangered.
And at this point, those Cavendish bananas that we eat are essentially all, they all require assisted reproduction. If you want another one, you've got to go through pretty much major hoops.
Yeah, if you want another one, you have to go through major hoops. And those hoops include the shipability, for example. A banana comes thousands of miles, so from the tropics to us. So a banana has to be bruise-proof almost to get to us. Ripenability. A banana can't ripen too fast or too slowly. If it ripens on the ship, it's bad by the time it gets to us. It has to resist disease. It has to taste right. It has to ripen in a way that we can recognize. In other words, it has to turn from green to yellow. Now, there are some great bananas, but they don't turn yellow. They don't indicate ripeness on the outside. So, and on and on. There are about 30 criteria that a commercial banana must meet. So actually, there are 1,000 types of bananas in the world. But really, at this point, only the Cavendish, which is that most threatened banana, meets those criteria, and that's the problem. It's not that there aren't other bananas. It's that there's no replacement for the one that we eat.
So let's talk about this disease that is threatening the Cavendish, the Panama fungus. What does it do to the plants?
So the Panama fungus, just to put it basically, it kills the plant. It's spread in dirt and water. It's completely virulent. It's incurable. It's fast-moving. And what it does is it gets into the vascular system of the plant. That means the water-producing system. And it kills the plant from the inside. It's a wilting disease. So it forces the plant to wilt, the leaves to wilt. And once it does that, the fruit can no longer produce the bunches of bananas that we need. And if you look at a banana plantation that's stricken like this, what you see is a wasteland. You don't see those tall, healthy banana trees with those large bunches. You just see a bunch of fallen down, ratty banana trees that don't look like much of anything.
And another consequence of that is that anything in the ecosystem that requires the shade of banana leaves to grow down at the bottom also doesn't do well.
Right. And so now that's not in a commercial banana plantation. You don't have stuff growing underneath. But in Africa, people rely on bananas as their primary source of nutrition. Now, you mentioned that 30 pounds of bananas that we Americans eat every year. It's actually about 25. But in Africa, people rely on bananas as their primary source of nutrition. In Uganda, for example, it's about 900 pounds of bananas a year for some people. That's 80 to 90% of their calories. But in addition, that banana is part of a village ecosystem. So you'll have that tree providing shade for up to a dozen different plants and vegetables and things like that. So if that tree falls down without that shade, you lose the rest of the things that they grow. And so people starve without those bananas, but even the other things that they might grow to replace those bananas can't exist. So it's a really serious problem.
Science and Nature writer Dan Coppell is my guest. We're talking about his book, now out in paperback. It's called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. So, Dan, are antifungal agents useful at all against this disease?
Absolutely not. Panama disease, which is actually known as Fusarium wilt, that's the common name, is completely resistant to antifungals. And this disease has been around for over 100 years, and cures have been searched for that amount of time, and there has never been a cure. And it is unlikely that there ever will be at this point. Millions and millions of dollars and man hours have been thrown at it, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there's in terms of finding some kind of chemical cure, in addition to the problems with chemical cures in terms of how they affect the ecosystem and the health of workers, it's unlikely that one will ever be found.
And are quarantines effective, or is the assumption that with a globalized world they will only last for so long?
Quarantines are useless, and it's not necessarily a globalized world. It's true that the disease spreads so rapidly. A single clump of dirt can affect an entire plantation and then an entire country's worth of plantations, and that's the way it spread throughout Asia. It spread in Australia that way. And once it's there, it's easy to spread. For example, in Latin America, if it comes, and it will come, once you get it in a, let's say, a place like Honduras, in a plantation — Honduras is a huge banana-growing country — well, as soon as there's a hurricane, and we know there's lots of hurricanes in Latin America, all that water and dirt that's thrown up in the wind is an ideal way to spread this. But it can also spread on a truck tire, a machete, a tool, the sole of a shoe. So quarantines have been proven to be useless, and there's just no way to do it. It's not a hopeful situation in terms of building fences around banana plantations.
And in fact, this has happened before. People of a certain age will remember that bananas used to look and taste different.
Yeah, they may not remember, but if they're reminded, they will. And the banana that built the banana industry was introduced about 120 years ago. It was called the Gros Michel banana. The one we eat now is called the Cavendish. The Gros Michel banana was a bigger, tastier banana. It was tougher. It resisted shipment much better. It ripened more evenly. And the only problem with the Gros Michel was that it was very susceptible to Panama disease. And by the time it was introduced, not long after, Panama disease began ravaging it across Latin America. And by about 1950 to 1960, the Gros Michel was over. It disappeared as a commercial breed. And this Cavendish banana, which was considered a junk banana by Chiquita and Dole, was adopted really as a last resort at the last minute. Like I said, it was considered not very tasty, not easy to ship, not easy to ripen. And the only attribute it had was that it resisted Panama disease. The problem is that a new strain of Panama disease has emerged, and it affects the Cavendish. And there is no ready replacement at the moment.
So there are basically dueling approaches to trying to deal with the current infection. Can you talk about the pros and cons? And it sounds like both sides are sort of against the other in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there are dueling approaches. Approach number one would be genetic engineering, trying to build resistance into the banana so that it doesn't get affected by the disease. And that would be through either high-tech genetic engineering, or which means inserting DNA into the banana and trying to make a new banana in the lab, or through hybridization, which would be a more conventional form of growing a new banana, or a combination of the two. The second one would be diversity, variety, having more than one banana available to consumers. I actually think both approaches are going to be necessary. And I guess there's a third one, which would be trying just to find a replacement banana, even though one doesn't exist. There may be some out there, and there are some potential candidates that are problematic. But I think all three approaches are necessary. And my point is that, really, those approaches are all going to take time, and time is running out, and the banana companies are only now just beginning to think about this. I mean, very recently, in the past year or two, and any one of those approaches is going to take years, at least 10 years, to get to develop any kind of new banana, whether it's finding a new one out there, genetically engineering one, or developing a sort of banana diversity in the plantation so that all our bananas are not in one basket, so to speak.
Yeah, and then you have to ramp up production, which is what caused quite a delay between the demise of the Gros Michel and the rise of the Cavendish.
Yeah, you do. You have to ramp up production, and you have to change the supply chain, which is really the difficult thing. The Gros Michel was very easy to ship. You just threw it into a boat. Cavendish, you had to box it, bag it. You had to use controlled gas atmospheres in the boats to keep it from ripening. You had to do all kinds of things. So you have to really reinvent the way the banana is brought to us, and this takes time. And so the banana companies really need to start experimenting, and in fact, they are. They won't really tell you they are, but they are. They're beginning to think this is real, and you know, they won't really tell you they think it's real, but I know, and the people out there where they're experimenting know that this is something they're beginning to think about. And there have been some remarkable developments in genetic engineering also. The problem with that, of course, is that most people don't want to eat a genetically engineered banana, and in a lot of places it's against the law to sell a genetically engineered banana.
I was fascinated to read that Chiquita and Dole started out as railroad companies. Can you talk about how they got into the fruit business?
Yeah. One of the founders of Chiquita, which was then called United Fruit, before it was even called United Fruit, was a guy who was hired by the government of Costa Rica to build a railroad across Costa Rica. And he had this idea that in return for building this railroad, he would get the rights to do whatever he wanted on the land surrounding the railroad. And one of the things he did was he grew bananas, mostly to feed his workers. Well, he pretty much realized that bananas were going to be more profitable than the railroad, and so he started shipping the bananas back on the completed tracks. And he met a guy in Boston who was already selling bananas, and they formed a partnership. They called it United Fruit. And they single-handedly created a market for what really was an impossible product. I mean, this was in the 1880s. This was a product that was shipped thousands of miles under refrigeration, and they sold it for less than half the price of apples, which were grown couple of hundred miles from most American cities. And within a matter of a few decades, bananas were outselling apples by 2-to-1 in America. And they've continued to do so for over a century. It was really sort of a bit of marketing genius, although there was a very dark side to it as well.
Yeah, we will definitely get to talk about both of those things, the marketing genius and the dark side. And the phrase Banana Republic is definitely a real one. We'll get to more of that in a minute in our discussion with science and nature writer Dan Coppell. His book is called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. It's out now in paperback. If you want to join our conversation, you can get on the line and call 1-800-933-5372 or write an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dan Coppell. He's the author of the book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I guess, Dan, there has always been significant money in banana exporting and sales. And what kind of cooperation did that require or did that demand from local governments in the regions where these things were grown?
Total cooperation. Remember I said that bananas were always meant to be sold. These banana guys wanted to sell the banana for half the price of apples. That was key to their strategy. It was going to be the staple fruit. Yet bananas had to be shipped thousands of miles under refrigeration to these markets, and then they had to be distributed, and bananas go bad within 2 weeks. So how do you make bananas cheap? Well, you have to have cheap land and cheap labor. In fact, you have to have basically free land and free labor. So in order to get this, you needed very, very cooperative governments. And either the governments cooperated or new governments were put in. And basically that meant military intervention. And over 20 times between about 1900 and 1960, the banana companies brought in the military and overthrew governments. This was the U.S. military, the U.S. CIA, and they massacred workers. They stopped worker movements. In 1929 in Colombia, workers were massacred, about 3,000. Their bodies were thrown into the sea. 1954, with the authorization of President Eisenhower, United Fruit, which is now known as Chiquita, helped overthrow the democratically elected government. This was so common that these countries that were controlled by the banana companies came to be known as the Banana Republics. And Chiquita was known in Latin America and still is as El Pulpo, which means the octopus, and that meant their many tentacles. And so it's a tragic, tragic history behind our cheapest and most beloved staple fruit.
And President-elect Obama's pick for Attorney General, Eric Holder, has worked for Chiquita in the past.
Yeah, and it's an interesting and disturbing thing. Chiquita's skullduggery has not totally ended. It's better, and the company has done a lot to change. But just a couple of years ago, it paid a huge fine to the Justice Department for supporting terrorist groups in Colombia. They made payoffs for the right to grow bananas there, and that money allegedly was used partially for drugs and for assassinations. There are a couple of lawsuits now filed by the families of American missionaries compensate them because that terrorist group murdered those American missionaries, and they're saying the Chiquita funds helped buy those weapons. Eric Holder, Obama's choice for Attorney General, as a private lawyer, is defending Chiquita against that lawsuit and presumably will no longer be doing that if he's confirmed. But right now, his job is to defend Chiquita, and I find that very disturbing. Even though companies do have a right to a defense, I find it disturbing that that's a job that he would take.
Meanwhile, I guess it was this year, Motley Fool called Chiquita the worst stock in the world.
Yeah, Chiquita does not do well. They're constantly hit, at this banana crisis with their public relations problems, and their bad reputation, which is somewhat, I wouldn't say necessarily undeserved. They are diversified beyond bananas. And someone asked me yesterday, well, why don't you say Chiquita and Dole? Because Dole has not done the greatest things either, and they're not just banana companies, and perhaps we should say Chiquita and Dole, just like when we talk about soft drink companies, we should often say Coke and Pepsi, or we should always say McDonald's and Burger King. But for better or worse, Chiquita was that very first banana company back in the 1880s, and they still are the banana company, and so we do talk about them, and when the banana industry is hit, it's Chiquita stock that goes down more than Dole's.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Dan Coppell is the author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Let's speak to Chuck in Dallas. Hello, Chuck.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a comment. This is a subject I know a lot about. I've consulted with the large companies on this subject. The fungus that I believe is being talked about in the business is referred to as Ciguatoca. It's commonly seen down there. They've been aware of it for years. They fight it very aggressively, and they have techniques in place to do it. The banana referred to here as the Cavendish, there's actually close to 2,000 varieties, sub-varieties just of it. Those companies that have been discussed so far have experienced outbreaks of it. They have a very defined procedures for going in, clearing out a particular area, and replanting another variety to get by it. They use artificial intelligence programs to monitor weather, number of hours of sun, rain, things like that. And in the case of rain, if there's not enough, they can supplement that. If there's too much, they have drainage. Banana plants are planted in a row at very specific distances between plants, and the rows are very specific distances between rows to provide for irrigation. So this is not a new
Chuck,
issue.
I'm very glad you called. Ciguatoca is actually not the virus,
right,
or the fungus that we're talking about here.
Ciguatoca is not the fungus. The fungus is called Fusarium oxysporum. Ciguatoca is controllable with pesticides. This is a different fungus. It's called Fusarium. It is the one that wiped out the Gros Michel. So Ciguatoca is chemically controllable. There are four varieties of Cavendish. They are distinguished by height alone. They are genetically identical. I'm sorry to contradict your listener. What he said about Ciguatoca is correct, and what he said about those planting techniques is correct, but we're not talking about Ciguatoca here.
So unfortunately, it's not completely under control, the situation with the other fungus.
Right, and I'd advise anyone who wants to learn about that to just Google Australia and Panama disease and learn about the devastation that Australia's very sophisticated first-world industrial banana complex has suffered. They are more equipped than anyone to stop any kind of banana disease because of their highly organized efforts, which we're unable to do in Latin America with subcontractor plantations and small plantations, and they have failed.
The banana industry has been very innovative in terms of technology and really creating new systems of production and distribution. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the banana industry, their ability to innovate is incredible, and everything we know about the way fruit is distributed is really invented by the banana industry. Refrigeration and distribution, barcoding, is a precursor to barcoding or invented by the banana industry in terms of coding on boxes. If you look at these banana boxes, there are long numbers that tell exactly what plantation it came from. And even in the future, Dole, for example, is working on a shrink-wrapped bananas that could be sold in convenience stores. I just came back 2 days ago from Belgium, where I was doing some banana research, and in the Brussels airport, Chiquita is selling individually barcoded bananas. they're selling them for about $3 a piece, by the way, which is airport pricing. They are incredibly innovative for these fruit. They really just are brilliant at that, and you got to give them credit for their ability to come up with ways to sell this very simple, humble fruit, and ways to ship it and transport it. Necessity is the mother of invention. To get this perishable product all those miles, you gotta be really bright.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to James in Allen. Hi, James.
Hi. I was wondering if the author could address this. I once read a cost-benefit analysis on the use of a chemical called, let me see if I can get it right, bromochloropropane on bananas in Honduras, and the known fact that it was a carcinogen on the applicators, but there was a cost-benefit analysis saying that even though we know it causes cancer for the people who apply it, it's still worth it based on the increased production that it causes the plant. I wonder if the author knew anything about the topic, and if you could discuss it briefly.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, cost-benefit analysis of whether things cause cancer in workers. I would say to anyone who, with all due respect to the caller, I'm sure he's asking a theoretical question, but my answer would be to go work in a banana plantation and do the cost-benefit analysis when the chemicals are falling down on you. Just to answer a little more seriously, what happens with these chemicals is that you require more and more sprayings of them. For example, this Ciguatoca disease, which your earlier caller mentioned, it is controllable with chemicals, but you need more and more chemicals. So 10 years ago, you needed to spray once every couple of weeks. Now you're spraying three times a month. And so workers are exposed to more and more chemicals. A lot of these chemicals are considered safe by the Food and Drug Administration or by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for home gardening. So you'll read, well, these are safe. But the problem is that they're not safe when they're not sprayed in the correct way or when they're sprayed in incredible amounts. And in addition, you know, you might do a cost-benefit analysis related to cancer, but you're not doing it related to sterility or blindness or skin diseases. So these analyses are not good. They're not good ways to measure. You have to measure a different way, which is suffering versus what product we're getting out of it. And I think that's the proper analysis.
Well, and I'm curious, too. I mean, in this country, although we certainly love bananas, and you mentioned 25 pounds a year, they are ultimately sort of a luxury to the extent that we have other produce available. What will happen in those places where people are eating hundreds of pounds of bananas a year if the Cavendish is wiped out?
Well, first, let me say that I don't actually think bananas are a luxury. And my point of view has changed a little bit since I wrote the book. And I think one thing that Chiquita gets right is that they position the banana these days as an alternative to junk food. If you look at the banana, it's even if you buy it individually in your Circle K or your 7-Eleven, you're going to see it selling for 50, 60, 70 cents. That's about the same as a bag of chips or a Snickers bar. And I think that's really an important thing for us to think about. Now, this is putting aside the issues of pesticides and stuff like that, which we shouldn't put aside, but just for the moment. You know, we are an incredibly unhealthy society, and the banana is sort of the last bastion as an alternative to that. And I think that's really important. It does sit there and fight that off. So, but to answer your question, what will happen in these African and Asian societies where the banana is so important? I mean, that's a huge question. I just got back from Congo. I was there for most of December. And in these villages, people rely on bananas. That's all they eat. That's all we ate. And all I can say is imagine if you couldn't eat anything and you had no way to get anywhere to eat anything. These folks don't have cars. They don't have any means of transportation to go somewhere and get food, and there's no good way for food to be brought to them. So answer the question, your listeners can answer the question themselves. If you lost 80, 90% of the stuff you eat, you're not going to last long. And these bananas are sick out there. They're not 100% sick. They're losing 40, 30, 50% of their crop, depending on their villages. And it's getting bad. And so what happens is a disaster. You have famine, you have war, you have all the things that are attached to that. And it's a crisis.
Is there such a thing as an environmentally responsible banana consumed in this country?
First of all, I'd say that, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about local consumption, locavores, what's an environmentally responsible food, what's not. It's hard to single out the banana. I mean, so much stuff has so many facets to it. So I would say, maybe this sounds like an excuse, but the banana is no better or worse than anything else. There are organic bananas out there, which are good, and there are fair trade bananas out there, very hard to find, which means the workers are treated a little better, or a lot better, depending on who you ask. So those are good things to support. My real issue is more that the workers are treated better, and I think that's something we really should advocate. In addition, I think it's important to have banana diversity, more than one banana on store shelves. That's a long way away because the techniques need to be invented to bring those bananas, and those bananas need to be identified. So I'm a little less concerned with sort of the carbon imprint of bananas, since I think that's a wash when it comes to pretty much everything we eat, than with protecting the fruit itself by encouraging diversity and not this monoculture we have. And I think that's the way to make it safer. And I think that's something we consumers can do something about by asking our grocers, by literally saying, hey, why do I have five apples and only one banana? By learning that there's 1,000 different bananas out there and that people can actually request, the other delicious kinds.
Yeah, an email from Carl in Denton, who spent some time in his childhood in Brazil in the 70s, says, I recall something called an apple banana, which had a distinct apple-like flavor. Where would one find alternative varieties here in the U.S.?
Brazil.
So even Central Market or some of the fancier grocery stores don't carry still a lot of varieties of banana.
Yeah, you know, there are a few varieties available out there. Your Whole Foods, your gourmet health food stores will have some of your Latin American markets. You will find them. There are occasionally apple bananas out there. Chiquita and Dole both sell these, they call them baby bananas or minis. Sometimes that will be an apple banana, which is a banana that's a little tart and tastes like an apple. They're delicious. Fundamentally, about 99.9% of our banana market is Cavendish, so you're not going to find many of them. Now, I will say that Brazil is the best place in our hemisphere to get bananas. The Brazilians are the third biggest banana-growing country on Earth. They have an incredible variety of bananas. Their bananas are amazing, the apple banana, the ouro, the silver banana, the gold banana. They hate Cavendish. They know it's a bland banana. Brazil doesn't export any bananas, really, to speak of. But, yeah, if any of your listeners are feeling rich this year, which not many people are, and they're contemplating a Brazilian vacation, they should definitely make it their business to try some bananas from out there. Otherwise, they're going to have to look pretty hard. They should try the red banana, which is, I know, is available often in Whole Foods Market. It's a red-colored banana. That's pretty good, and that's probably the most common alternate banana you'll find in it. Uncommon world of alternate bananas.
Dan Coppell is my guest. His book is called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. We'll take a break and talk about the culture of bananas when we come back. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Science and nature writer Dan Coppell is my guest this hour. His book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, has just been re-released, this time in paperback. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Before we move on, Dan, a question about whether plantains are also affected by the Panama fungus.
Absolutely. Plantains and bananas are basically the same. It's just that one is not as sweet. Plantains are basically for cooking, although you can cook yellow sweet bananas as well. So, yeah, plantains are affected by the Panama disease fungus as well as the 12 other major diseases that affect bananas and that can be equally devastating.
So let's maybe think about something a little more pleasant. Is it true you found evidence that the banana may have been what Eve used to tempt Adam, and not an apple?
Sure. The major evidence is that if you look at the oldest Hebrew translations of the Bible, the banana, the word apple does not appear. That only started appearing in the Middle Ages. The word in the Hebrew text is fig of Eve, and fig of Eve in those old Hebrew dialects is the word used for banana. So it's that simple. It was the banana, not the apple.
And people have been using these for all kinds of purposes, including passing secret messages to one another.
Yeah, the banana was used during the Inquisition in Mexico. The inside of the banana was used to pass messages between prisoners, condemned prisoners in the jails. Bananas are used for fiber. They've been used to make paper. there's actually the banana is related. There's a banana plant called an abaca, which does not fruit, and the fiber in it, it grows in the Philippines, is used to make our manila envelopes. And so, yeah, bananas have all kinds of uses other than for eating.
And the banana companies have always been really, really good at getting us to eat their product, as if most people needed much incentive anyway. But for one thing, the idea of slicing up a banana in your cereal.
Yeah, like I said, these are brilliant marketers. When the banana was introduced, people didn't know what bananas were, and so they had to educate us and incentivize us. One of the things they did in the Chiquita Test Kitchens was come up with a recipe. It was a recipe. Slice bananas into breakfast cereal and pour milk over them. And to get us to try this recipe, what did they do? They came up with coupons on the back of cereal boxes that gave you free milk if you bought a bunch of bananas and a box of cornflakes. And notice that they didn't give you the bananas for free. They made the milk free. So it was the milk people who paid for this promotion. Very, very brilliant.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Dan Coppell is my guest. His book is called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. We have an email from Stephen who says, my wife and I beg to differ. We stopped eating bananas because we don't think they taste as good as they did when we were children and even as young adults. I don't know, Stephen doesn't say how old he is, but perhaps he was eating those Gros Michel bananas at some point.
Could be the Gros Michel. Could also have to do with the shipping. When bananas are shipped, they're preserved with this ethylene gas, and gas-preserved bananas do not taste as good. So that could be one possibility. If people are over 60 and they have exceptionally sophisticated taste buds, they might have noticed that those Gros Michels did taste better. Gros Michels are still grown in local farms in Africa where they're not near other diseased bananas, and I just had some a couple of weeks ago, and they are much better.
I take it you travel a lot. It must be tough for you as a sort of a now banana connoisseur to have to march into the grocery store and get the same kind over and over.
Yeah. I mean, I can order a sandwich without white bread, but I can't order a banana. It's not Cavendish, unfortunately. But, you know, it's still a banana. It's still good. I don't mean to put the Cavendish down. It sounds snobby. I mean, the Cavendish was a perfectly okay banana. There's nothing wrong with it. Like I said, it's a great alternative to junk food, and it's fine. I just would encourage anyone who has the opportunity to find an alternative to ask for one, because they are better. But the Cavendish is fine. It's humble, it's workmanlike, and it does just fine.
I want to talk about this old joke about slipping on a banana peel, because people kind of roll their eyes at this and assume that it's just some bit of slapstick, but this was a serious problem for a while.
Yeah, again, the genius of the banana companies. They created demand for this completely unfamiliar fruit, and the demand became so huge so quickly that nobody knew where to throw these bananas away. Now, this was before the advent of urban sanitation systems, and people were just throwing bananas on the street. And these peels would rot away, and people would slip and hurt themselves. And your listeners might say, oh, come on, that can't be true. But in fact, during my research, I uncovered things like city ordinances, one in St. Louis in the early 1900s, that specifically prohibited people from throwing banana rinds on the street. It didn't say fruit peel. It said banana rinds. The Boy Scouts in the early 1900s, in a list of suggested good deeds for the day, suggested that Boy Scouts go out and pick up banana peels. And in New York, one of the reasons they started their street sweeping program was to pick up banana peels. And so this became a problem, and as the problem eased with these laws and people getting garbage cans, it became a bit of a joke, and that's why it's funny today. And so this is how amazing these banana guys were. They actually became so popular, this fruit, that a crisis emerged.
And there are also banana trade wars on occasion.
Sorry, banana...
The trade wars?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Right now, there's a huge trade war. The Europeans and the Americans are constantly fighting over who can import bananas to Europe. Chiquita is locked in a battle with the European banana importers. Chiquita says, you're not letting us import enough bananas to Europe, and you're being protectionist. It's pretty much true. The Europeans have favored markets, and Chiquita has constantly been more or less winning these battles with the World Trade Organization and still somehow can't import enough. What Chiquita is doing now is launching banana plantations in Africa where they're going to be allowed to import more. Now, in terms of free trade, Chiquita's probably right. In terms of banana plantations in Africa, this creates another opportunity to spread banana disease, and that's probably not a good thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Z in Dallas. Hi, Z.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I would like to ask your author there what he knows about the habit of smoking banana peels in the 60s.
You know, that's one of the frequent questions I get asked, and that, unfortunately, it was a myth. That wasn't true. It didn't do anything. If it did, it was purely a placebo effect. However, many banana varieties, not our Cavendish, unfortunately, do contain high levels of dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that makes you feel good. And so bananas do have somewhat of an antidepressant effect. Cavendish does contain a small amount, but some of the Pacific varieties, which maybe one day we'll get here, do have significant amounts of dopamine and actually can make you feel good in a very positive way. So bananas could be one of those food products that could actually help people feel better without having to resort to pharmaceuticals that attempt to hit the same neurotransmitters.
And there's also been some work in certain places about putting vaccines into bananas. Is that right, to deliver them to children and threatened populations?
Yeah, there's been some work in that, and there's also been a lot of work in enhancing the vitamin A content of bananas, which is actually probably coming online pretty quickly. And the idea is that when people eat bananas, when they're used to that, they're going to be more willing to consume their medicine or vitamins within a banana. And this is through genetic engineering, so some people oppose that, but I think it's a pretty good idea, especially the vitamin issue. Vitamin A and vitamin D deficiencies are huge problems all over the third world, and people tend to be very mistrustful of vaccinations. I just experienced that in Congo. People ask me over and over again, well, would you get your kids vaccinated? I think it's unsafe. I think it's a conspiracy. I don't know about the ethics of hiding vaccines in bananas, but I do think it is probably a better way to deliver it if it's possible. Than through needles. There is work being done in that.
Can you talk for a minute? I thought this was fascinating about what it takes to get a banana seed if you happen to need one for some reason.
It takes forever. If bananas are basically seedless, occasionally you will get a stray mutant seed. Not in Cavendish, you'll never get that, but in other breeds. And you basically have to look forever. If you get a banana plantation and you want to find a single seed, you're going to have to send out dozens and dozens of people, and they're going to have to look for months and months and months. They're going to have to crush 100,000 bananas to find one seed, hundreds of thousands sometimes. So you really have to spend, you know, a year's worth of man hours at least just to find that one seed. But why would you do that? Because that seed is breeding material. It's conventional breeding material. Other than that, you have to resort to DNA manipulation. And again, even though I think that's safe, you've got the problems of expense, ethics, and all the other issues attached to that. So in order to hybridize bananas, you need to find those seeds. And you want to get seeds from basically seedless bananas, because if you're hybridizing from seeded bananas, which are basically wild bananas, you're starting with material that has a lot of seeds. So it's going to take you many years to breed those seeds out. So it's in your favor to go out and spend a year looking for a single seed in what are fundamentally seedless bananas, because then you're working with basically seedless stock. But it is worse than a needle in a haystack. It's a needle in a billion haystacks.
And then only a fraction of those seeds that are found actually germinate.
Right. This is why, for example, one of the few successful bred bananas has been the product of over 50 years of regeneration. In other words, it was started, that this line was started over 50 years ago, and it's been bred and bred and bred and bred and bred and bred and rebred. And it's only in the past 10 years or so that actually a viable banana has been has emerged from this, and it's not even commercially viable. It's viable as a subsistence banana, which has a much lower bar in terms of what it needs to do, what properties it needs to have for people to accept it. So it's a tough problem.
Why is it so difficult to get, not that we necessarily want artificial flavoring, but things that are supposed to taste like banana never do?
Banana's a tough taste. I don't really know why, but you're right. I mean, if you want, banana Laffy Taffy, you have to be into that flavor and not banana flavor. You have to celebrate the artificialness of it.
Right, like we know what banana flavoring is, but it has nothing to do with the actual fruit.
Right. I mean, you have to sort of be into the it's the Britney Spears of banana flavoring. You have to go for the kitsch of it. And then if you want a banana, eat a banana.
So if you were going to recommend that people go, and you mentioned Brazil already, sort of on a worldwide tour, are there a few banana varieties that you would suggest people taste if they have the shot at it?
My current favorite, and I have to say, it's the most delicious banana I've ever tasted, and I just tasted it for the first time 4 weeks ago, is a variety I found in Africa called Ibota Ibota. That's spelled Y-B-O-T-A, Y-B-O-T-A, and it was in the Congo, and it is a what they call an apple banana. That's a variety type, but it had about three different flavors: apple, then sweet, then very creamy and intense, and it was just totally delicious. And man, if you could go out and get that. Now, the word was that it was originally a banana from Thailand that was brought over probably by Asian workers at some point in the past 75 years. Somewhere in Africa, but nobody really knows that for sure. There's some work being done to identify it. It's tough to do, but that banana was great. So if you happen to be in Central Africa, look for that one. Otherwise, go to India and just go to any small village and ask for the village banana, because in India, they are proud of their bananas. Their bananas are delicious, and just let them lead you wherever they want to take you, and you will find amazing bananas.
When will we know for sure whether the Cavendish banana, the common everyday banana, is in fact on its way to extinction?
You'll know when you start when Panama disease hits Latin America. Nobody knows when it's going to come. As soon as it hits, it's going to spread quickly. Like I said, this disease is spread on a clump of dirt. It moves very quickly. It has not hit Latin America, where all our bananas come from. Nobody knows when it's going to come. Everybody knows it will come. The analogy I like to use is it's like having a gas leak in your house. Nobody knows when anyone's going to light the match, but eventually there will be a spark, and when it comes, it's going to happen very quickly. And when it does, you're going to learn about it, because these banana plantations will start to fold. If it's in 5 years, it's going to be really bad, because it'll take at least 10 years to develop any of these alternatives we've been talking about. If it's in 10 years, hopefully by then there'll be some alternatives and they'll be folded in. So let's hope it's at least 10 years, and we'll have some alternative bananas by then.
Dan Kopel's book is called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Dan, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.